We found life on Mars. Now what? This week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Hoping you and yours are staying well. No, you didn't miss the biggest headline of the century. Finding life on Mars is still just the goal and dream of millions, including our two great guests. Penelope Boston is a world-renowned astrobiologist and would-be Martian. James Green is chief scientist at NASA. They recently joined me for a live conversation sponsored by Explore Mars, and you'll hear most of it in minutes. Then we'll drop in or drop up for a visit with another chief scientist, our own Bruce Betts. Here we go. NASA and SpaceX have set the 27th of May as the launch date for SpaceX's Crew Dragon to carry astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley to the International Space Station. The milestone launch will be the first carrying humans from Florida since the end of the space shuttle program 9 years ago. Planetary Radio and Planetary.org will provide coverage leading up to this big event. That's just one of the stories you'll find in this week's downlink from the Planetary Society. Here's more. NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft completed a sample collection rehearsal at asteroid Bennu, coming within 75 meters of the surface before backing away, as planned. The probe is scheduled to actually touch down in August, when it will grab a small sample of regolith for return to Earth in 2023. Japan's Hayabusa 2, now on its way home from asteroid Ryugu, arrives late this year. And CHEOPS, the European Space Agency's characterizing exoplanet satellite, has observed its first distant world. The target was a puffy gaseous planet, 30% larger than Jupiter, that is orbiting a star 320 light-years from us. CHEOPS is designed to precisely measure the diameters of known exoplanets, which will also reveal more about their compositions. You can get more at planetary.org/downlink, including a free subscription to the weekly newsletter. The Planetary Society isn't the only space organization that has turned to the web as an alternative to in-person events during these crazy times. Our sister organization, Explore Mars, has also begun an ambitious series of live, interactive discussions. It was my honor to host the first of these for them on April 1st. The topic was Life on Mars, Implications and Impacts. Penny Boston, Jim Green, and I talked about the status of the search for life on the red planet, what form that life might take, where we may find it, and perhaps most dramatically, what may happen when we discover we are not alone. We've got a link to the complete video on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio, including the great slides Penny and Jim presented and the audience Q&A segment that I've omitted here to save time. The audio quality of what you're about to enjoy is not up to our usual standard, but I think you'll find the conversation as fascinating as I did. Let me set the stage for today's conversation with a hypothetical. We've jumped forward to 2024. A rover named Perseverance, that we'll be talking more about momentarily, has been rolling across Mars for 3 years. Another visitor from Earth, a more recent arrival named Rosalind Franklin, has been pulling up samples from below the surface of Mars. NASA and the European Space Agency have just announced a joint press conference that is going to reveal images and other data indicating that we just may have found strong evidence of life. Will this news, as my boss Bill Nye likes to say, change everything? What do we do next, and how will it affect plans to send men and women to Mars? But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's back up a little bit and talk about the current status of exploration on Mars now and what's going to be happening there, well, in less than a year now with the arrival of this new rover. Tell us, what's the status of Perseverance?
Well, Matt, Perseverance is actually moving forward. It's all down at the Cape. And in fact, the radioisotope power system is already connected. It's checked out in many ways. It still has a number of things to do yet, but we're making great progress. So it is on track for a July 17th open window for us to be able to launch. And that's when that highway opens up for the next 3 weeks that can get us to Mars.
This is like almost everything NASA sends to around the solar system nowadays, an international effort, right?
It is, and indeed.
Penny, you have spent a good part of your life going to places most of us would not want to go, looking for how life has found a way to survive. One of those more milder locations, I remember being with you at Carlsbad Caverns, and you pointed to a spot on the wall, and you said, you see that? That's life-eating copper. So it does sure look like the enormous variety of extremophiles that we find on our planet. It's got to give you some encouragement, right?
Oh, very much. Even though I'm a Mars fan for my entire life, of course, I have an eye on the other potential habitats. And I think that the fact that we have organisms that appear to be able to tolerate almost everything, including high radiation and organisms that have been retrieved from, you know, space exposure and complete desiccation and living amongst metals that we find toxic, but they're busy using inorganic chemistry to make those into energy sources, makes me really understand the sweep of what our type of life, meaning organic carbon in a water matrix, is capable of. It's really quite extraordinary.
Life as we know it.
Yeah, life as we know it. And of course, you know, many of us consider life as we don't know it. And that life as we don't know it extends to other ways of making life, even out of organic carbon. So there are people thinking about other alternative sets of chemistry that might work on other planets. But from the point of view of Mars, my conviction is that we're really looking for carbon-based life in a water matrix, because Mars is not all that different from Earth. And certainly, as Jim pointed out, early in its history, it was much more similar. And so that early childhood of our rocky terrestrial planets together seems to me very significant. And even Venus, in its current state, which is quite inhospitable to life as we understand it, but its early history may have also shared in a habitable zone. So it's not just Mars alone that is compelling, but really Mars as this beautiful red jewel within this entire spectrum, this entire crown of jewels that we have in our solar system and what they offer for life.
Jim, I want to jump back now to that hypothetical that I posed at the outset. That press conference, which you would very likely be a part of, I hope you're still on the job in 2024, you've got big news for us.
Right.
What's this going to mean if indeed we find evidence better than we've gotten in the past that seems hard to argue with, that maybe we have found at least evidence of past life on Mars? What's that going to mean to us here on Earth?
Well, let me just mention, of course, there is an important aspect of thinking about that future when we start that announcement. And that really boils down to looking at what's happened in the past by analogies. On that press conference, we would have the scientists that are announcing the discovery, but also scientists that are a little skeptical. That announcement then would go out to the public, and then there would be a period where the community of scientists would really dig into the results. Perhaps if we return samples soon after that, they would then be able to have those in the laboratory, et cetera, and really tease it out, and then public reaction. And then an education has to go on to everyone in terms of the context of what this means. But if we just take that supposition that indeed in the long run, it proves to be true, and we have found that second genesis and it is on Mars, what does that mean? And here by analogy, I think we have to look at perhaps several. One comes to mind is what Copernicus did. At the time, Copernicus was coming out with the theory that the planets went around the sun and not everything went around the Earth. It changed the world view. Everyone mentally had to now rearrange their thoughts about their place in the solar system and the universe, and it had a profound effect. People thought, well, we are the center of the universe because everything goes around us, and now they go around the sun, just like the other planets. And then to them, that means, well, maybe there are other societies like us on other planets. This was a really profound change. I think, indeed, We're going to have to come to grips with that. Many people, because of our literature and our movies, are, you know, all set to accept that there's a second Genesis out there. And in fact, many scientists, and that would include me, think it's almost inconceivable that there isn't some sort of life out, not only in the solar system, but certainly on other planets. And so our worldview then, once again, will have to change.
Penny, what would this mean to you and your colleagues, this announcement and the provision of this data?
Well, you know, I spent my entire life doing this, and so have many of my colleagues. So I have dreamed about that happening in my lifetime. I hope it does. I'm trying to stay as healthy as possible to get the maximum chance. And, you know, the minute we got any kind of indication that there might be extant life or even extinct life, okay, because I also do paleomicrobiology and I'm interested in the entire deep history of planets with life, the entire community would go into a frenzy of trying to test whatever features this potential life would have. And so there would be an enormous flourishing, maybe in directions that we're already pursuing, maybe in new directions. It depends on what those results would find. And then I would throw one heck of a big party.
I'd like to attend that.
Please invite me.
I will.
Penny Boston and Jim Green will return with me in a minute for more about the prospect of life on Mars. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related, we invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. If our robot explorers find life, that is, existing life, on Mars, what would that mean for humans going there? That's where my recent Explore Mars-sponsored conversation picks up with Penny Boston, astrobiologist and former head of the NASA Astrobiology Institute at the Ames Research Center, and NASA chief scientist Jim Green, who led the agency's planetary science division for many years. You're only hearing a small portion of what was our live discussion. There's much more great stuff on this week's episode page at planetary.org/radio.
For human exploration, I think we'd have to talk about how we're going to share Mars. And I think we can share Mars. We would plan to go to one particular area, perhaps a 150 or 200 kilometer area called an exploration zone, where we land in one part, live in another part, and then have the ability, mobility, to go around and perform a whole variety of scientific experiments, but really confine ourselves to that part of Mars. And in so doing, then, it gives us a wonderful opportunity, perhaps over several decades, of continuing to go there and continuing to build and develop things at that site, an opportunity to really learn and obtain a deep understanding of what Mars is all about. And then we can take it to the next step with that kind of knowledge. So I'm all for sharing Mars. Now, you may know that many scientists, particularly Carl Sagan, thought that if we found microbes on Mars, we need to leave Mars alone and go to another body in the solar system. But I think because life also has to evolve over time, the evolution of that life is going to be completely different than ours. And that gives us, I think, an opportunity to coexist. And those are some of the new ideas that are coming out now.
Penny, what's your view about all this? I mean, I think you want to see boots on Mars as well, but...
I'd like to see my boots on Mars,
actually. Me too.
But I'm going to be too old, I'm afraid. Mm. But it's something I've wrestled with my entire career because I have this desire for exploration for our species to go beyond to other bodies in our solar system. And who knows, someday even out of our solar system. In some number of hundreds of years. But at the same time, of course, I'm very, very aware of the deep ecology aspects of another biosphere. And this applies to Mars or any other biosphere that we may find in our solar system. And that is, how do we study it? How do we perhaps cohabit with it, as Jim points out, without doing damage to it, and in turn, without doing damage to us? I think that many years ago, probably 25, when I first started writing about the Mars subsurface as being the best place to look for life on Mars, it was not taken very seriously. We knew a lot less about the planet at that time, but we've plugged along on that theme, and I think it's become manifest that that is the place, as Jim says, where we would have the highest chance of finding subsurface life. Even if Mars once was covered in life at the surface, that the subsurface in many cases, particularly even on Earth, is a refugium, a refuge for organisms when circumstances change on the surface. And that helps us with this conundrum, because as long as we don't contaminate aquifers, as we're trying to get resources for human use, then the surface Mars environment is very harsh. And while I wouldn't call it entirely self-sterilizing, it will do a lot to reduce the plume of biological contaminants within some distance from a human colony. There are ways to do this. And, you know, we're living through it now with this pandemic that we're all experiencing. How do we separate our activities from, in this case, a pathogen? But in the case of humans on Mars, how do we separate ourselves from potential organisms that are the Martians and keep all of us safe? And so all of these real world things are being worked out in real time. It's very, very much foremost in our minds about how to do this safely. I think we can do it. I hope I'm not being naive.
Penny, you touched on it, but it's a question that Explore Mars CEO Chris Carberry posed before we started this, and that is whether what we have learned about both how we might handle isolating ourselves from life on Mars, or anything else in the field of astrobiology, might have helped prepare us to deal with the challenge that we're facing around this planet right now, the pandemic. I mean, do you see any relationship there?
Yes, I do. I think that one of the things that this horrible circumstance will maybe help is eventually in better public communication.
What's critical also to understand is, you know, viruses aren't considered alive. They really are cellular parasites, if I were to describe them in some way. And they invade the body, and they have some genetic material associated with them. But in reality, for them to live and grow, they actually have to co-evolve with a host. And so when we think about bringing material back from Mars that is alive, that life has perhaps a second genesis, perhaps is related in some way to us in terms of the fact that it started in a similar environment like Earth, but it has a completely different evolutionary track. And so the current thinking is, yes, we're going to quarantine those samples. Yes, they'll be in what we call a biolevel 4 facility, you know, where they handle anthrax and everything else, and it will be closely monitored. But I think, as Penny points out, our ability to understand that the microbial and virus environment will allow us to use those current tools to interrogate those samples and begin the process of releasing things to the science community. Many places around the world that will really tease out some of the most spectacular science in terms of really having a deep understanding of that planet than we can dream of today. Now, I was alive in high school at the time of the lunar landings, and it was just awe-inspiring, even with the grainy, yucky, you know, black and white TV.
Yeah.
And so today we're going to be doing it in high definition, and the colors will be spectacular, and the shadows will be long, and it will be incredibly eerie, but it will be just as inspirational. So everyone, you know, that hasn't seen that original lunar landing of any of the Apollo astronauts have really got a treat in store for them, and that's coming up.
What a great way for us to end this wonderful conversation. I want to thank both of you. There truly were no better people to be a part of this discussion of life on Mars and why we examples of life down here are so excited about it. Keep looking up there at Mars. We're there and we're going back. Thanks for again for joining us. Have a great day and stay safe.
Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Jim.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Matt.
Astrobiologist Penny Boston and NASA Chief Scientist Jim Green. Thanks again to Explore Mars at exploremars.org for allowing me to host that conversation. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. That means that we are joined by the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society, the Program Manager for LightSail 2, which could be over your head right now.
In fact, it probably is.
We're everywhere. You can't escape us. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
I got a message from Allie saying that her boyfriend Galen is an avid listener of Planetary Radio and a member of the Planetary Society. It's his 30th birthday on May 2nd. She's hoping that we could express our No, I'm sorry. Give him a happy birthday wishes. As you know, Bruce, we can't do that. We're sorry.
No, we cannot.
Like if we did it for you, we'd have to do it for, let's all say it together, everyone.
So in the night sky, we've got in the evening, Venus now at the brightest pretty much that it ever is, a ridiculous astronomical apparent magnitude of minus 4.7, which is really, really bright. It has also moved into being a crescent, if you look at it through a telescope, and it will get more crescenty, get dimmer, and start dropping lower in the west after sunset in the coming weeks. So check out Venus. In the pre-dawn, we've got the three planets hanging out. Upper right is bright Jupiter, and this is the pre-dawn east. Bright Jupiter, yellowish Saturn, and then reddish Mars as you go towards your lower left. Mars is separating away. It doesn't want to associate with Jupiter and Saturn anymore. Those gas giants, you know, social stigma.
They're gassy.
We were looking for one comet to brighten in May, and then we were looking for another, but Comet Atlas, she's breaking up. Also, seems to be disintegrating, so I wouldn't get your hopes up for a bright comet in May, but we'll keep you posted. Oh, wait, it almost is May. Let's move on, shall we? On to this week in space history, 1989, Magellan was released by the space shuttle and headed off on its way to radar map the surface of Venus.
Oh, and radar. Radar's going to come up again.
Oh, cool. On to space. I went down a rabbit hole learning about this. So I'm sure Matt and many of our listeners are familiar with the astronaut symbol, the U.S. astronauts, and the lapel pin, which looks like three lines headed up to a star going through a halo or an elliptical thing. Well, it turns out, at least according to the Manned Spacecraft Center's roundup from 1964, that those three lines, rather than just being kind of a generic shooting star kind of looking thing, actually represent unifying the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo teams as one set of astronauts. I've also seen things that don't refer to it that way, but it seemed like a pretty good source. What's also interesting, and part of this random space fact, is that they are awarded silver lapel pins when they graduate from astronaut candidacy to being full-blown astronauts, and then they get gold ones when they fly in space.
That is fascinating. I did not know that. Now, really, they ought to add two more lines, one for the space shuttle and maybe now for commercial crew, which is about to happen.
The circle ellipse represents an orbit, by the way, not surprisingly. So orbiting the Earth.
Okay. Not the moon.
Take your pick. I don't know. I'll dive back down the rabbit hole. Let us move on to the trivia contest, shall we? You wild man, had NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine on a couple shows ago. So I asked, in what kind of aircraft did NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine fly combat missions off the carrier USS Abraham Lincoln? How'd we do, Matt?
One of our few non-space-related trivia questions. We have a winner. He's a past winner, but it has been nearly 2.5 years since Neil Ashelman's name came up in the random.org hopper. Neil, out of Davenport, Iowa. I happen to know that he's right about this because it's right there in Jim Bridenstine's official NASA bio. You can even find it on our website, I'm told. It says, Jim flew the E-2C Hawkeye.
But wait, we had someone from Iowa win something involving the Hawkeye?
Yes, we did. Isn't that wonderful?
That is. That's nice.
He says, the strange radome on top of that bad boy, or its earlier cousins, always fascinated me as a kid. Congratulations, Neil. Neil is one of those who we are going to offer an outgoing message or whatever else you want us to record. We just recorded a couple for a couple of the other winners from Bruce and me for your voicemail system, or replace your doorbell chime with it. That'd be fun.
Nice.
Martin Hajoski. He now spends, that is Jim Bridenstine, now spending a lot of his time in congressional hearings. Might be wishing he was back in combat.
Maybe.
That's it for this round. We have a cool prize for the next time around. Yeah, you want to start that up for us?
Back to astronaut pins. Whose silver astronaut lapel pin is on the moon? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until Wednesday, May 6 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. And here's the prize. The great space artist Michelle Roush, she had given us some stuff, donated some work to give away some time ago. And somehow this fell between the cracks, apparently, or into a crack, I suppose. It's a print of Neil Armstrong that she did, let's see, about 6 years ago. It apparently has been a very popular work from her. It comes with a certificate of authenticity from Michelle, and this will be yours. It's a lovely print, number 11 of 500, of Neil, the first man himself. I have it here, so it'll be easy, relatively easy, to get it out to our winner.
Excellent. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about marsupials. Thank you, and good night.
Maybe I should have said it. It must have fallen into someone's pouch. By the way, Michelle's website is www.roush, that's R-O-U-C-H.com. I bet you could just do R-O-U-C-H.com. My fellow traveler over there is Bruce Batts. He's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. And if you manage to join us in time, you can join us live at planetary.org/live for What's Up Live. We'll post it after the fact for those of you who missed it, and you can enjoy it in retrospect as well. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members, who know that we are the Martians. Mark Hilvert is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Be safe, everyone. Ad Aries.